Welcome to this installment of ACM SIGMOD Records' series of interviews with distinguished members of the database community. I'm Marianne Winslet, and today we're at the L3S Research Institute in Hannover, Germany, where I'm spending the fall of 2006. Today I have here with me Stefano Ceri, who's a professor of information engineering at the Politecnico di Milano. Stefano's research interests include distributed, deductive, active, and object-oriented databases, as well as query languages for XML. His current research focuses on the design of web applications. He's a co-inventor of WebML, web modeling language, and has a startup company that's commercializing WebRatio, a product based on WebML. Stefano is a founder of EDBT, where he's still a member of the endowment, and he is a 12-year member of the VLDB endowment. Stefano is a former editor of ACM Transactions on Database Systems and a former editor of IEEE Transactions on Software Engineering. He's the co-author of 9 books and his PhD is from the Politecnico di Milano. So, Stefano, welcome.
Thank you so much. Very nice introduction.
Most researchers put most of their energy into conference papers. What led you to write 9 books in 18 years?
Well, it's a sort of style, because I like, first of all, to study an area, of course, write some conference or journal paper. Then at some point, when I feel that I understand enough about the area, I would like to write a book about it. That's also a way to get away from it, because normally when I write a book, that's the last thing which I do in the particular topic, and then I move to another topic.
Okay.
And that happened for active databases, for deductive databases, for distributed databases, as a matter of fact. It didn't happen that much with the last book which I wrote, which is about web design, because I'm now doing a startup on this topic, and therefore I'm still working a lot on the same topic as the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the exception. But normally the idea would be to finish with a book. I also remember discussing with Jeff Ullman one time that there are researchers which are a zero book researcher, or one book or many books.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently we both belong to the many book category, although Jeff has written many, many more books than I did
mm-hmm.
in his life.
Okay. And you also have a lot of journal papers. Do you favor journal papers over conference papers?
Well, the problem with conference paper is that given the particular taste of my research, which is mostly on modeling, on, trying to understand the requirements and so on, conferences are not that easy, because to some extent the conference papers adopt a kind of syntax, which is the sort of well-known Wisconsin model, where you basically have, first of all, to define a problem, then to sort of define a solution, then you have to quantify how better is the solution relative to the previous solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get the 30% advantage, you are fine, otherwise you uh-huh. don't even submit the paper. And if you need to have this kind of format, then it is difficult, I think, for whoever has no quantitative measures to put
yeah.
out. So I think this is actually a mistake that our community is doing, to leave away from, the conferences, the contribution that cannot have such a quantitative description and analysis in the end.
Well, then, with work on modeling, how do you prove that your modeling approach is better?
That's the point. It is very hard to prove that the modeling approach is better, because you cannot really count, the satisfaction of the person that is using the model. By the way, I think it is an important factor for the success of our field.
Yeah.
To be able to give the best methods, the best tools, the best environments, and so on.
Uh-huh.
But these things are hard to count. For instance, we are able to count in the software engineering field things such as are called function point, which are quantifiable, mm-hmm. and then we could publish in that field.
Mm-hmm.
But it is more difficult to do it in a database field for something which is a model.
Mm-hmm.
So this mm-hmm. is, I think, one of the reasons why we turn to journal papers more than conference papers.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it is a fair process where you start discussing with reviewers,
yeah.
and after a while the reviewers understand that what you are doing makes sense.
Yeah.
And so in a couple of iterations you can bring your thought out, while in the conference mm-hmm. situation. Sometimes it's more a matter of, let's say, taste, good luck, not finding the reviewer that doesn't understand the approach.
Yeah.
So I think it is more, let's say, the process is more under control when you publish in a journal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the community likes a lot of conference papers, so,
and
that's what we need to do. But recently, for instance, I had papers in WW conferences,
yeah.
for instance, more than Sigmod or VLDD.
Okay. Is it true that you got your PhD before your master's?
Yeah, this is a sort of funny story. So when I got my degree in the Politecnico, there was not yet a PhD program. So I got the maximum degree that I could get, and it was a doctor's degree, but it was not equivalent to a PhD. And it was also in electrical engineering, so I didn't feel that I had enough background for computer science. So what I did, after being a researcher, I had already my VLDD papers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I went as a master's student to Stanford University.
Mm-hmm.
That was 81. In retrospect, it was a very, very nice time which I had. I had the chance to meet professors such as Jeff Ullman or Gio Riedero,
mm-hmm.
but also other people such as Hennessy or Floyd,
mm-hmm.
or gurus like McCarthy.
Yeah.
And all these people were sitting around in the small computer science department, and you could breathe their presence.
Yeah.
And this was really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Don Knuth was giving his final lecture, I think, of the year when I was at Stanford.
Uh-huh.
So it was really a good time for being at Stanford.
Uh-huh. Okay. In 1990, you wrote a paper called Object Orientation and Logic Programming for Databases, A Season's Flirt or Long-Term Marriage, Which has it turned out to be?
Well, probably a seasoned flirt with some sort of born children that might not have been wanted from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, in the object-oriented world, I think object-oriented system promoters wanted to have more success, more visibility, and in the end there is not, let's say, the object-oriented per se success, but object-relational is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And even the marriage that now takes place between object-oriented languages such as Java and let's say relational implementation is very important. So I would say that object-oriented has become more and more powerful,
mm-hmm.
although not along the lines that were expected to be if you read the manifesto, for instance, of
mm-hmm.
object-oriented databases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and similarly, rules... I think rules didn't have equivalent success, quote unquote, but they are very important. For instance, when I teach in my class, I always teach deductive and active rules
mm-hmm.
As two separate components. And it turns out that this gives to students an idea that a database is much more than a box for storing content. It has
mm-hmm.
also all kinds of knowledge about this content.
Mm-hmm.
And then to some extent, it gives to the field a more higher status that the student would appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
So by putting mm-hmm. rules around the database, I think we get this result. And then there are applications, but maybe not as successful as one would expect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You've also worked on supporting workflows, as have quite a few other members of the database community. What impact has workflow research had on how companies conduct their business?
Actually, companies do conduct their business doing process modeling. So that's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Do it by means of BPMN, doing it by means of BPEL, doing it by means of UML, derivatives, whatever it means.
Mm-hmm.
But they do, I've learned that it is important to model the process.
Mm-hmm.
And this has come out from, let's say, the experience that comes from workflow modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the technology of workflow tools is not very much used. So if you ask yourself how many applications use workflow tools, probably very, very few.
Oh.
But the idea of workflow as in the sense of process,
mm-hmm.
and then modeling the process, and then coming slowly from the process description down to software, I think is picking up very solidly, and it has an impact.
So why don't they use... tools also. What's the missing ingredient in
actually
the
they start using tools. They use tools. As a matter of fact, for instance, we are negotiating a contract with a big Italian company that would like to have a method and tool associated, which are sort of, let's say, well understood and well, let's say, presented to them through the help of the Polytechnical.
Yeah.
Because they really want to standardize how they go from requirements to software.
Ah.
And that's the phase that they are mostly interested in, which means how to model the process and then how to model the data, of course, and then to sort of produce a requirement description.
So in that case, their process is actually creating software.
Yeah, I mean,
I was imagining just ordinary business forms.
Right. So that's when we are discussing about the process that leads to build to software design.
Uh-huh.
Well, in terms of process modeling, I think, I mean, again, there is a need, but this is not done too much by computer scientists. More done by, let's say, the business-oriented people.
Yeah.
But they do use process models.
Okay.
But they have their own slant. It's not supposed to become a process model that you can implement.
Oh.
It's more a process model that you use for doing analysis.
Okay.
So there are some differences, I would say.
Okay. Should computer science professors worry about tech transfer of their research?
They should. They better should, because, for instance, if I consider how much money do we get as a department in total, we get, let's say, 5% from the university and 95% through contracts.
Mm.
So you have to get contracts, and therefore this means to be able to solve some existing problem. That means to do some kind of technology transfer.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that starting from a real problem is always good, because then you have some kind of clue on an existing problem, and then you apply a solution. To some extent, at this point, you can think whether your solution is good enough and to be generalized.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is still space for invention, abstraction, and so on, even if you start from a concrete problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, you risk to do an abstraction that has no relationship whatsoever with reality.
Mm-hmm.
If you do, it becomes much easier to abstract the right concepts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, technology transfer is very important. Now, another question is how much is it evaluated in the computer science community? And here it is very hard. I mean, I would say that some computer scientists don't really evaluate the advantage and the beauty of bringing a solution up to a concrete problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's still this, separation between, more theory-oriented, but even theory can be very much applied to concrete problems.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the difference is really between who finds an external reason for starting the work that then can become really is even basic level, but at least it has some foundation, which is promoted from an external institution, as opposed to the people who really think about their problems and then think about their solution and then they are done.
Yep.
Okay.
You are the chairman of Laurea Online, is that how you pronounce
yes.
it?
Okay.
Excellent. A fully online curriculum in computer engineering. From this experience, can you tell us what the trickiest issues are in online education and whether it will replace face-to-face college education?
Whether. But let me start from the end. Replacing face-to-face, no, that's not the what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, Laurea Online is a full bachelor curriculum, so we offer 28 courses of 5 credits each that can be composed into a curriculum.
Uh-huh.
And it is really something where Politecnico has invested and we have done it in a consistent way. Our students in the end don't have a degree which says online. It only says computer science.
Yeah.
It is exactly the same quality and seriousness in the teaching. The student in this case happened to be typically working people. So we address a different student population. Working people or people which live far away from Milano.
Mm-hmm.
We have things such as virtual classes where they meet at typically at times which are good for them, like in the evening or during the weekends. And they can do co-browsing, co-editing of shared resources, so there is the tutor that can explain what's going on, they can do projects, they can do whatever kind of... And this kind of communication actually sometimes turns out to be even more, let's say, alive than a communication that you have in class. Because it's like there's a community, sort of virtual community that is created based on that, which is very nice. Mm-hmm. I really like the kind of relationship that you establish with the online students. Mm-hmm. And of course they have to come to COMO to take exams. COMO, because COMO is offering the curriculum. So the exam is in presence.
I see.
They do midterm, final with, say, written orals, whatever.
Okay.
And they do it once for 1 week, which is a very intensive week where they do all the possible exams.
Cool.
But that's similar to the semester system, I think, in the States, where we have the week of exams. So that's the same thing.
Okay. So you're saying the average student is taking more than one course at the same time, even though they're working?
Yeah, they normally take about half of the courses than an in-class student. Okay, so the student in presence would do the curriculum in 3 years, maybe they could use 5 to 6 years.
Yeah.
They could, and we have set up a program in this way.
Okay. And what's your enrollment in that?
Students. We have like 170 students total, which means in the various stages. Now, there are other uses which we conceive. For instance, we have some other master project programs which can use the same courses. The same courses can be used by the students when they join the, let's say, graduate level courses, but they come from different institutions, or they anyway have some, let's say, we call it debts. They have to take some exam that they didn't do in their past curriculum, but they do it online.
Yeah.
Because that's the easiest way for them. They don't have to worry about the scheduling of these courses, which would be... So there are applications of online besides just regular students. And as I said, the Politecnico has maybe order of 25,000 students. So it is not the purpose of the Politecnico to do online education. It's only for this particular degree for these particular students.
Okay. Do you see any new data management challenges that the database research community should be aware of?
Okay, I think the database community should be more aware of the problem of the web, but that's somehow obvious because I am doing a lot of research on the web. I think the database community has somehow missed some trends. Although, if you look at the major companies such as Google or Amazon, they do know perfectly well the technology.
Yeah.
But there is a mismatch between what is inside the companies and what we talk at school or the kind of research that we do, which seems not to be matching very well. Now, in my feeling, we are about to go for another, advantage in the web, the so-called semantic web. And that's a trend that the database community should not miss. I mean, the ability to describe services in a massive way, the ability to adapt queries due to personalization to the right service, the ability to reason about what is the best, quote-unquote, opportunity for a user request, a user query to be serviced in the large web. It's a problem that we should be more aware and more conscious. Otherwise, other people will do it. And this is something that I think will shape in the next 5 to 10 years, at least in the web world, for sure.
Well, those are popular research topics in my department. Are there any other things people are overlooking on the web?
What do you mean?
Well, all the issues that you mentioned are things that professors in my department are working on.
We do.
So when you talked about where what Google is doing is not represented in the universities, do you mean that we should have a course that talks about those sorts of things?
No, I'm just saying that if you look at the amount of research, which is, well, that's might be not exactly, this is too extreme as a position.
Yeah.
But I think we should put more emphasis on research. For instance, let's take personalization and guessing what are the tastes of a user. So this kind of thing requires monitoring, requires, let's say, combining knowledge that you have from the domain, knowledge from the user, knowledge. Mm-hmm. Do we want to be interested in this? Or do we want other communities to do this instead?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we don't have at the moment, let's say, this is a perception, maybe it's wrong, a good mass of, let's say, research which is oriented towards solving the massive problem that you may have in addressing the web as a large database.
Okay.
Maybe it's just a wrong perspective and everybody's doing it. I don't know. I mean, that's my feeling.
Okay. You've spent dozens of summers at Stanford. What do you see as the main differences in the U.S. and European approaches to research?
Well, lots of differences. So,
ah.
Well, first of all, resources. Mm-hmm. Also, closeness to a market which is very responsive.
Okay.
And therefore, as soon as you do something, you immediately, that has some potential, immediately people comes to you and talks to you about what could be done with your research.
Mm-hmm.
And in Europe, it's go the other way around. We have to sort of dig out the contacts and dig out the... So technology transfer is very different,
mm-hmm.
for sure. In terms of research, I would say sometimes it happens to me to think that in the U.S., you tend to go more deeply into a narrower field, for instance, for a PhD thesis.
Yeah.
So you become the world expert in that particular field.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean perhaps that you have enough breadth of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, if you invest to go in depth, maybe you don't invest to go in breadth.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a difference, that we go more in breadth and maybe not the same.
I see. Uh-huh.
Again, in a very generic way.
Mm-hmm. Any other differences worth mentioning?
Well, as I said, to some extent, you mentioned that I've been going to Stanford 20 or so years in my recent life.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is not so big, although I've been at Stanford almost every summer. When I was going to Stanford the first time, I was feeling there was a big gap between U.S. and Europe, or Italy.
Ah.
Like a five-year gap, which I was closing by crossing the ocean.
Oh.
But now internet makes the gap much shorter.
Yeah.
So, and we are doing research with colleagues in IBM and Stanford, IBM,
right.
One of them I mean,
yeah.
So in the States. So the point is that it is possible to do research across countries easily because of the communication technology. So as a matter of fact, I didn't go to Stanford in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But that's because I felt that I could live very well doing vacations.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was not disconnected. I didn't have this gap to catch up because I felt that what we were doing was state of art because we could look it up on the web,
could
have discussions. For instance, when we do discussion with some colleagues in the States, we also use all kind of video communication technology, co-browsing, and so on. And it becomes very effective. It's like being in the same place.
Nice.
So.
Okay, great. The European funding agencies seem to like big projects. How can you do research in such big teams?
Yeah, that's another point. We have projects which may have order of 8 with a small size up to 20 with a big size.
Mm-hmm.
These are called STREP or IPs, the European know very well. Now, I have not a bad experience about this project. Actually, WebML was conceived during... First of all, we had... there have been 7 rounds of experience. There are 6 rounds and the 7th is coming out of the programs. We always had the program, a project within each and every... round of European projects, programs. And this has been very healthy because that's been probably 70% of our funding.
Ah.
And so I cannot complain. And also we have invented WebML through one of these projects and then we have developed it through other 2 projects.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been very also effective for the company and for this research. So I think in my case, I don't have a bad experience of this. Of course, it's very difficult to set up a project. I mean, you spend a lot of time finding the right consortium.
Yeah.
And my experience is that if you write a good proposal, normally it's accepted. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people write very bad proposals. They put together consortium in a very weird way.
Yeah.
And then the proposals are not accepted. But that's uh-huh. somehow, say, consequential.
Uh-huh.
So I think the model itself, of course, is much more complicated than the U.S. model when you apply to a funding agency to get your... But the cooperation might be helpful mm-hmm. sometimes, mm-hmm. not always.
Okay. The Lowell and Asilomar reports on future directions in database research. What do you think about such reports and their impact on database research?
Well, you mentioned Lowell and Asilomar because I was there both times, and, mm-hmm. and so this was very interesting species, especially Asilomar. Mm-hmm. This was on the coast in California. I remember a very nice discussion with Kristen Mike Stonebaker. Mm-hmm. Telling about how we solved Illustra to inform. I don't remember exactly the details, but it was interesting to hear this in a firewall, so to speak.
Yeah.
Just to... there was another thing which I remember. At this Asilomar workshop, I remember saying there are three things which are important in databases, which is semantics.
Mm-hmm.
Coming after Bruce Lindsay, famous... words that there are three important things: performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is becoming the fact that semantics get yeah. more and more important for, mm-hmm. for the database community. So this was like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I asked my student, "Did you ever heard about this?" Because they have a few students here.
Yeah.
Here now, and the answer was, "Yeah, but we don't really remember what is
what
in there."
They
say. So maybe it's rather more relevant to us as let's say building the field consciousness
yeah.
than to the student itself.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But that might be that's just a special question, so which was a special answer.
Okay. Tell us about your startup company.
Okay. So, well, we did a startup which actually was using a patent that we have written together with Politecnico. So Politecnico owns part of the startup. It's part of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... this also, to some extent, marks a big difference between the startups in Europe and startups, at least the startups which are university, let's say, started. Because, for instance, for us, it is clear that we will steadily grow, maybe without doing much effort to have a big boom at the very beginning. That's the typical way in which we doing a company from inside university,
mm-hmm.
think that it would be the best way to operate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and mm-hmm. For instance, we didn't use any venture capital,
uh-huh.
and we did our steps one after the other. And
yeah.
I think now we have a very good product.
Uh-huh.
We have very good. We have many customers.
Uh-huh.
Interesting viewpoint. So, and it has been very interesting for me being a professor.
Mm-hmm.
To meet this totally different world where
yeah.
the client is always right and you have to
yeah.
sort of see what are their needs, and it's very interesting. And the company is doing well. We co-founded it together with Piero Fraternali, who is my colleague,
yeah.
and also together with three students who are now the CEO of the company.
Yeah.
And
can you say a couple words about what the products do?
Yes, the product is a tool. It enables to design web applications. So
mm-hmm.
you design the application with modeling, of course, that's my specialty. So you have models for the data, model for what we call the hypertext,
mm-hmm.
that is the description of the web interface,
mm-hmm.
and then model for the presentation, the look and feel.
Mm-hmm.
They are orthogonal, and then once you finish to do the model,
yeah.
you just develop the software by having code generators.
Yeah.
So you never program a solution. And it is, let's say, platform independent. So it can work with arbitrary databases, arbitrary
yeah.
web servers, arbitrary
uh-huh.
environments.
So it's kind of like an application generator for
It's an application generator for the web. Mm-hmm. Very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. We include web services. Mm-hmm. We participated to a, let's say, a competition for semantic web, mm-hmm. where we just used the plain web ratio as it was,
yes.
and for modeling B2B let's say solutions.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be the most complete solution.
Okay.
And this was like in the last. June,
I think you got a prize for that.
An IBM award. So it's this modeling the semantic web mm-hmm. through this model-oriented tool is probably our next step.
Ah.
And it looks to be very promising.
Okay, great. Do you have any words of advice for fledgling or mid-career database researchers or practitioners?
Probably I already gave it. To look for existing problems, mm-hmm. then try to generalize these problems mm-hmm. And come up to solutions that mm-hmm. Are... and then at this point you both have a practical problem
yeah.
problem on your hand mm-hmm. and the generic solution that you can publish as well as you can be.
Okay. From among your past papers, do you have a favorite piece of work?
Ooh. Actually, there are many, many, which are the summertime papers with Jennifer, because I remember visiting us at IBM while I was at Stanford, and every summer we had the PLDB paper. So we did this for 4 years.
Ah.
But then I would say I had a lot of co-authors, which are wonderful people mm-hmm. In my life. Gottlob, mm-hmm. Gio Widerold, Sean Navate, mm-hmm. Letizia Tanca. With Piero Fratanali and Stefano Paraboschi, we have been a prolific trio somewhere,
yeah.
I remember seeing in the Sigma record. So, and there's a piece of work which is coming out which I like a lot, on data mining, on the next TODS. So I actually, this would be the TODS in beginning of 07, March 07.
Data mining, that's a new
so
topic.
So that's a new topic,
you.
That's a new topic, exactly.
So what have you done in data mining?
Actually, the idea was to try to come to a totally different approach to data mining. So we call it pseudo-constraint. It's the idea that you would like to find in the web, in the database, mm-hmm. Things which are not constrained because they have some violation, but they are almost constraints.
Yeah.
And then you can express this constraint and mm-hmm. then find the violation. Mm-hmm. And these things happen to be the interesting thing that you mine from a database.
The violations or the constraints?
Both.
Both.
I mean, the violation are instances. Mm-hmm. And the constraint gives you a rule. Mm-hmm. It is almost a constraint. Mm-hmm. And you combine the knowledge of these two things, so you can understand a lot about the underlying domain. Mm-hmm. And for instance, we discovered things. We had an example which was taken from a bank, and we discovered some weird things that happened about how this is... just public data, so there's nothing mm-hmm. very bad about it, but things like, for instance, whenever there was a given transaction, there was also another transaction.
Yes.
From more or less the same author, the same person, but was not exactly the same person, only a person with the same birthday and sex and everything, but not the same name. So something
very
weird, very strange.
Yeah.
So and this was possible to find. It was a sort of constraint.
What was the constraint? Was that violating?
There was this rule that would say that every time a transaction would exceed a given amount, you would find another transaction,
uh-huh.
more or less of the same size, and that was actually in place. Details are in the paper, so you can read the paper.
Okay. If you magically had enough time to do one additional thing at work that you're not doing now, what would it be?
At work, I would try to combine my hobbies. So, for instance, music,
mm-hmm.
because I think there's a lot of to do with music and computer science, which has not been done yet. So, for instance, when I listen to music, I used to also read the book about mm-hmm. the music,
mm-hmm.
and I would like to see multimedia things, multimedia, let's say, tools.
Yeah.
Where you can read the music, listen the music, see the performance, maybe point to a line of music and listen to a specific instrument.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot to do in this kind of, let's say, making music popular for the listener. Mm. And that I would like to do, but of course I don't have no time. But it would be an interesting and challenging project, I think. How to make this, because I have the state to listen to the music specifically, reading the music and so on. And I think this could be very much helped by computer science.
Well, there is work on music information retrieval, query by humming.
Yes, yes, but not, I haven't seen yet the kind of thing that I would like to buy on the shops. And I would like to buy it on the shop.
Maybe your next startup company.
I don't know whether I will have another startup company, but that's maybe.
Maybe Jeff Ullman would say there's zero startup company people.
So maybe I'm a one startup company person.
If you could change one thing about yourself as a computer scientist, what would it be?
All right. Well, I think I wouldn't change it, but let's say the time when I make a choice was after I finished the master.
Yeah.
By the way, I met my wife Teresa in at Stanford. That was really a very good year. And then we had to decide whether to go back to Italy or to stay in the States. We had offers for jobs.
Yeah.
Maybe also offer for university. And then you have to choose what to do, and we decided it was better to spend 2 months in the States and live in Italy rather than spending 2 months in Italy living in the States.
Yeah.
So that was a difficult choice. And I think it would have changed a lot in my career, because then I would be more close to the database industry and more close to, say, opportunities, quote-unquote.
Right.
But on the other end, I think I don't complain. It was nice to be where I was and to teach to the student, which I got, and I feel not unhappy about the choice.
And you haven't missed out on the startup company boom either.
No, and that's a good thing. So well, we missed the boom. We came a bit later.
Yeah.
When we were already declining.
Yeah.
And so that is better, because if you hit the boom and then you are in the middle of the
bust,
it's a nightmare. And I know many people who are unhappy about meeting the boom.
Yeah.
And now it's a bit, I think things are going slower and more steadily.
Great. Well, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.